Japan's population trend being what it is, it's a lot easier to find singles and couples, or maybe a couple with a child, as opposed to a big family who are the ones who will be renting the houses.
Yeah.
The other thing is that how can I put it? In between tenants, when you have to renovate the place, you have a much bigger floor plan that'll cost you more to renovate. If it's a studio or a two-bedroom apartment, then it's a lot cheaper between tenants.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, land, it's true that you get a larger land plot with a landed property. With a condo, you obviously just get a fraction of the land. But, I mean, Japan's major cities have been doing okay for the last 15 years, but that's on the back of 25 years of deflation. So I wouldn't bank on capital growth as like a major criteria. So from that aspect, we don't see. And also, to be able to afford within your budget, to be able to afford a house, it'll be an older house in a very suburban location.
Yeah.
So not even as attractive capital growth wise as a centrally located condo.
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima Magen, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is an audio-only conversation that I've recently had with an Australian investor who has plenty of in-depth questions about investing in Japan's property market. So we talk residential, commercial, minpaku, short-term stays, long-term leases, condos, houses, you name it. We also dig deeper into exactly how short-term stay licensing works, how renovations and repairs work, how we handle management of properties via various third parties. And then we talk a bit about his specific scenario. So what can 5 to 8 million yen get him, and where is capital growth feasible, and for what property profiles? Do properties come with parking spaces, and how does that change the required distance to station for investment properties? We also talk about building restrictions and zoning regulations, what happens as structures get older, caveats to look out for in purchase contract and property documents, and finally, how to choose the locations, where to invest, natural disasters, insurance policies against those, researching potential listings, in cases of condo units, how building monthly fees and owner unions work. And then we also do some live, although still audio only, sorry about that, live deal analysis. We talk renovation work, what requires approval, what doesn't, leasehold properties, viewing, structural inspections, and of course, our own services and what those include. So super deep dive into all things related to property investment in Japan and how it all ties in together. I know you like this one if you have any interest in the topic of investing in Japanese real estate. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Where do you want to start?
Well, you had a list of questions. We can start there if you want.
Yeah. All right. So okay, so investment opportunities. What sort of investment opportunities that you'd normally? Well, what's the most common investment opportunities that you sort of provide to potential investors?
Well, it depends on your budget and on how hands-on you want to be. Everything that you've written there is an option, but Some of them are more seasonal, fluctuating, like the Airbnbs and the beachside properties. Car parks specifically are very low yield and high purchase price to buy. So that normally is purchased by people who want to land bank and just cover costs until the land hopefully rises in value. Buildings, commercial buildings, industrial buildings, shopfront, garage, workshop, I haven't seen so much, but they exist. These are all typical asset classes. The easiest ones to buy, the highest supply in the market, is usually going to be residential properties. But there are commercial properties to be had as well, again, depending on your budget. Family houses are probably not the asset class of choice in Japan because they're built pretty flimsy. And once they hit about 30, 40 years of age, maintenance and repairs start getting very expensive. But yeah, and the bottom again, beachside property, apartments would usually, so buildings or apartments would usually be the asset class of choice for more passive investors and people who like to be more hands-on and tweak and play with creative strategies usually go for short-term or medium-term stays.
Are those people more people that are visiting or you know living there in Japan where they can actually you know go to the site and assess what needs to be done and then organize the trades from there or do the DIY themselves, that sort of thing? That because you know initially I would have liked that, but realistically, I don't know that I'll be there all that much. You know, like it'll be somewhere I go once a year, maybe if I'm, you know, if I can factor it in. Oh, probably I could do it once a year. But,
well, to be fair, the only clients we have who are DIYing stuff are people who are living in those properties or at least living in them a large part of the year.
Okay.
Normally, our investor clients definitely. They work through us and we work through property managers and renovation companies. If the property manager's renovation company is getting too cheeky or pricey, then we'll get a second opinion. But otherwise, we do it all through third parties.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's probably more the avenue I'd probably need to take then. As much as I'd love to be hands-on and, you know, doing the reno stuff mostly myself, but I won't be able to do that.
Well, in that case, we'd go for small buildings or individual condo units. I wouldn't advise to go for single-family homes. I'd rather stick to a more solid structure if we can.
Yeah.
What's your budget like, roughly?
Look, for a start, I don't know. You know, I've got a certain amount that I can use right now, but maybe I'd want to start at the lower end, so maybe what? Somewhere between 5 to 8 million yen.
5 to 8 million yen. So that's a condo unit. If it's closer to the 8 million yen, it'll be in a better location. But 5 is doable too. Should be maybe a bit more suburban, but doable. We'd normally aim for the major.
When you say suburban, does that mean within?
Sorry.
When you say suburban, does that mean like 45 minutes or an hour or more?
As long as it's within a major city and within city limits, which would normally not be more than 30, 45 minutes. Yeah, not more than that. Otherwise, it'll usually become a different municipality and a smaller township by then.
Yeah, okay.
We wouldn't go for Tokyo because prices are inflated and yields are very low.
Yeah.
But any of the other major 7 big ones, so Yokohama, Kyoto, Osaka, Fukuoka, Nagoya, Sapporo, with some caveats because they're a bit more blue collar and a bit rougher winter wise. But any of those smaller cities that are close enough to a big city, like Kobe City near Osaka, Saitama and Chiba near Tokyo, Kumamoto City, which is a prefectural capital here in Kyushu, which is southwestern Japan. Bunch of other smaller prefectural capitals that probably are not that well known, those are usually the locations we'd hit. So if it's a bigger town, if it's a bigger town within that budget, it'll be quite suburban. If it's a smaller town, it might be a bit more central.
Yeah, right. I looked at the most recent census. I should have printed it off. I would have been better prepared, but Yeah, it looks like, like you said, the capital cities have like a lot of population in them. Like, I was looking at it, it's probably like 300,000 or 400,000 in a lot of them. I'm not sure. Yeah, Tokyo's obviously got more than that. But,
well, the big seven are usually 1 million plus each. Yokohama okay. specifically is 3 point something million. That's the second biggest city in Japan. And then Osaka is 2 point something. Fukuoka, Sapporo, Kyoto are somewhere between 1.5 to 2 million. I can't remember the actual numbers. So the ones that you're looking at that look like 400 or 500 are what we normally call like second tier cities, not the big seven. But as long as the population is not in decline, it's good enough.
Yeah, okay.
And you'll get higher yields there, not as much capital growth potential, but higher yield.
Yeah, okay. Because that's the thing, like, I don't know. In Australia, it's a bit different where, you know, most people want to try and buy land size over, you know, over like a smaller apartment, I guess. It seems to be the trend that's shifted away from apartments. But you're saying over there, yeah, it's different in terms of the build quality. And that's the reason why people tend to, investors tend to stick to the apartments or condos. Is that right?
It's one of the reasons. The other reason is Japan's population trend being what it is. It's a lot easier to find singles and couples, or maybe a couple with a child, as opposed to a big family who are the ones who will be renting the houses.
Yeah.
The other thing is that how can I put it? In between tenants, when you have to renovate the place, you have a much bigger floor plan that'll cost you more to renovate. If it's a studio or a two-bedroom apartment, then it's a lot cheaper between tenants.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Land, it's true that you get a larger land plot with a landed property. With a condo, you obviously just get a fraction of the land. But, Japan's major cities have been doing okay for the last 15 years, but that's on the back of 25 years of deflation. So I wouldn't bank on capital growth as like a major criteria. So from that aspect, we don't see. And also, to be able to afford within your budget, to be able to afford a house, it'll be an older house in a very suburban location.
Yeah.
So not even as attractive capital growth wise as a centrally located condo.
Yeah. What about the condos? They don't tend to come with parking, do they? It's just solely the unit itself and no parking, or
yeah, some of them would have parking spots available for rent in the building, but they're not owned by the unit owners. So if you happen to get one with a parking spot, then your tenant might be able to rent it, which is a bit of a bonus for them. But with the smaller condos, again, the studios, one bedroom, two bedroom, those tend to be tenanted by people who don't actually own a car, so they want to be within 10 minutes walk to a train or subway or tram station, and they're not going to really need a car. If you get a family size property, then a car and the car parking availability becomes more of an issue.
Yeah, okay. Condos seem to be rather like small, right? Like what, 20 square meters, maybe even less.
Yeah, sometimes less. 15 to 25 is usually the ones that generate the best income. It's more, it's like hotel room size, basically. Small hotel room size.
Yeah, and their price still at that, what, 50,000, 60,000 is all you're saying, or?
Is it what, sorry?
So they're still priced around that 50,000, 60,000 for those smaller.
Yeah, depends on location and the age of the building, but in a good spot and in a, you know, reasonably not too old building, then yes, they would start at that. Not in Tokyo, though. In central Osaka, we're not going to be able to get them there at that price.
What about, you tend to plug Fukuoka, which is where you're based.
Yeah.
Often, that seems to yield pretty all right, doesn't it, at the moment?
Definitely better than Tokyo, but we're getting pretty close to Osaka levels, I think.
Yeah. And what about Kyoto? That would be out of the question. Or
which one, sorry?
Kyoto.
Kyoto? Kyoto is great if we can find a deal there, but there are a lot of houses there, not as many buildings, so we don't see that many condo units coming out of Kyoto, but when we do, we'll nab them, yeah.
Yeah, okay. move to got some more questions. So with investment opportunities, what I mentioned with the larger buildings and stuff, obviously the budget needs to be something rather substantial, not what I'm looking at, right?
Well, cheaper than Australia for sure, but still they'd start at around $350,000 US, $400,000 US.
Okay, so 500,000-700,000 Aussie.
Usually, yeah. So 40, yeah, I mean, we sometimes see a good one for 40, 45 million yen, but usually they start at about 50.
Yeah, that's a whole building. Is that what you're saying for that? Or?
Yeah, so two, three floors, somewhere between 4 to 10 units.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, those are the best of all worlds if you can swing them, because they do come with a larger land plot and you have the flexibility to experiment with short-term stays, medium-term stays, which is going to be a lot more challenging. With a building, you're not going to be... If you're owning a single condo unit... the owner union automatically prohibits short-term stays.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, medium-term stays, they can't legally ban you from doing it, but they don't like it. So we'll have to find a property manager in that area who's okay dealing with an annoyed owner union kind of thing.
Yeah.
They exist. We have a few customers with those, but they're a lot... I mean, you get a lot more flexibility if you own the entire structure.
Yeah, okay.
Whether it's a house or a small building.
So a house would definitely be out of the question, or?
Well, a house is doable at this budget if it's quite suburban and quite old, and then you would be able to experiment with short-term leasing. But before you go down that path, just bear in mind that that's a lot more hands-on than the kind of long-term tenant, cash in the bank every month kind of thing. They're seasonal, they fluctuate, tourists come and go. You have to constantly tweak your rates to be competitive with whatever other people are offering. Look at your vacancies, your occupancies, and, poke the property managers if they're not filling up the properties quick enough. It's not a full-time job, but it's definitely hands-on.
Considerations like land zoning, is there, say you buy into an area and it's, it's got like you said, it's got like the condos probably at an age where it's, maybe it might get an offer from a developer and get demolished. Where do you find out that information about land zoning for height of building limitations, floor space ratio?
That's all disclosed in the listings themselves. So when you look at the Japanese listings, you'll see a section that says usually it's 60% / 200%, which means you can cover up to 60% of the land plot, and the total floor plan of the structure can be up to 200% of the land plot. So like you'd have like 30 or 40% or 60% in each floor kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
That'll be available on purchase, but we're not going to be advising you to buy anything that's old enough for a developer to start looking at it. They usually start sniffing around at around 40 years of age on a building, and we would advise to buy something that's maybe 30 years or younger on purchase, and then after 6-7 years start considering reselling it. Because when they hit 40 years of age is when the maintenance expenses start to rack up a lot more frequently, and then yield starts to shrink, and that's when people are looking to sell them and their price kind of drops off a cliff.
Yeah.
Unless that area, if that particular area has gone through the roof in recent years, it'll hold its value or maybe increase. But otherwise, if it nears 40 years of age is when we'll start thinking about reselling it.
Okay. Wow.
So far, far before any developer will actually make a move.
Renovations on those condo units for houses, there's no building approval process that you need to go through, or
Interior work is not a problem, but you do need to notify the building, the owner union, because they'll sometimes say, okay, work is only allowed between, 10 to 4 o'clock and not on the weekend. So you have to make sure your renovators comply with that. But anything in anything interior is up to you. The balconies are part of the common areas of the building officially. I mean, your tenant is the only one who can use them. It's not like other people are going to come in and use this balcony, but they're not officially yours. So you're not going to be able to do much to the balconies. Even if you want to set up like an aircon unit and the engine has to sit on the balcony, you still need approval. Anything that goes through walls or to the balcony will need approval.
Yeah. What about... So that's considered leasehold over there, or is it like strata?
No, no, it's all strata. It's all strata. It's just that the balconies are part of the building, the communal area.
Common area.
Yeah.
They fall under common area, yeah.
Exactly.
So that falls under the strata commitment, having to rectify anything there.
Yep.
If anything goes wrong, yeah. Okay.
With a house, it's far less strict. With a house, you can do anything you want to the interior as well, obviously, but also a lot to the exterior without, as long as you're not, you know, adding another floor or expanding the actual footprint of the building, you should be fine. If you do want to do anything like that, you'll need to get approval from City Hall.
Yeah, okay. Because, yeah, I've seen some people change a front room to like a garage, and then they've done an addition to the upper floor, or they've extended at the rear.
Yeah, you can do that. They're not gonna, no one's gonna like prohibit you from doing that or take you to court, but then you're not gonna be able to register it if it doesn't comply. And then when you sell the property, then the buyer might insist that you register all the add-ons.
Yeah. Is that just done on a like title or?
On the title deed, like, yeah.
So you're saying, so there is a building process then where you need approval for some developments where you're adding and altering, or?
If you're altering the footprint of the structure, either by raising it higher or expanding it on the ground, then officially you need compliance. No one's gonna take you to court over it or give you any trouble, but it's not gonna be an official add-on, which might cause some issues when you try to sell the property down the track.
Yeah, that's similar to here. Yeah. What's the time frames for approval of people going that way then? Like, because do you normally need planning approval and then like building approval? That's how it is over here. But over there, that might be different, where it's just rolled into one. Hopefully, are they, you know, like, is it the same as if you knock down, rebuild on a vacant, like on a vacant block, as in you're building from scratch?
No, as long as you retain the foundation and the supporting walls, it's considered a renovation, not a rebuild, legally.
Yeah, wow. Okay.
So that's kind of, again, it's kind of easy here. If you do need to get approval, it could take a couple of months. But the question is whether they'll approve it or not, whether you're fitting within zoning regulations. I don't know. Depends on the project.
Yeah.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's akiya-mart, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
When you're buying a property, they normally have like... So the deposit a plan, and then it'll have, I don't know, is that what it's called over there? Where it's just like it's the plan of the actual subdivision, or or plan of the building where it's, you know, you've got, it's got, you have a lot, and then it's got restrictions that apply to that. Over here it's called 88B restrictions, but
I'm not sure what you mean. I haven't seen that, sorry.
Okay, so like if there's any easements, say it's like a land plot that I'm buying, it's got a house on it, and there's maybe a drainage easement across the back, or a sewer easement, or underground, or overhead power lines, like, is that stuff listed as restrictions? Am I going too deep here, or?
If there is anything like that, it'll be detailed in the property documents you'll get as part of the contract in the appendixes. So sometimes, for example, the water pipes leading to the property underground might be passing under another neighbor's property, so then you'll need to get permission from them if you want to do plumbing work on that section of the pipe, or your access road to the property might be on private land as opposed to public land. So there are some properties, especially the older ones that were built before zoning regulations, some of them might have something like that, but that'll all be detailed in the property documents.
Okay, all right. All right, what about considerations for when buying, like, where it's close to CBD, obviously jobs, businesses, shops, I don't know, schools, hospitals, universities, that sort of thing, like, considerations for investing, right, for when you're picking an area.
Your typical Japanese tenant is not necessarily going to be a student, or, I mean, again, depending on what you're going for. If you're going for yield, meaning you're going for the cash cows, you're probably buying something a little bit less central and a little bit of an older building. And they tend to attract more kind of working class tenants, or, like, you know, destitute or almost destitute pensioners who don't have families, or entry level office workers or shift workers, like low income tenants, basically.
Yeah.
So there's not a huge advantage unless you're doing short term or medium term, in which case you want to be a lot more central in more attractive areas. But those would cost more. They wouldn't be 5 to 8 million.
Areas to avoid. Why?
Sorry, I'm losing you there. I'm not hearing you well.
Yeah, it's pretty windy up and down outside, but can you still hear me or no?
Very, very vague.
Okay, what about now?
Now, much better. Yep.
Okay, so areas to avoid and why? I don't know, maybe like tenant frequency, turnover, moving in and out, crime.
Yeah, so the things we normally avoid is, number one, like we mentioned, cities with declining population.
Yeah.
Also, even if the population is stable but the city is super small, if it's like a one-horse town with a single employer or you know, a single place of work for everyone, then that might dry off, so we'd avoid those places. Crime is not a huge issue in Japan. Lower socioeconomic areas, again, there are lower socioeconomic areas in each city, but the higher you want your yield to be, the more you'll be within those areas and with that kind of tenant. So you can't totally avoid them if you want to get your yield.
Yeah.
Earthquake, floods, tsunamis, typhoons, those are hard to predict. The only thing we do have indication of is if the property is within a landslide risk area.
Okay.
So if and when the typhoons hit, which happens usually once or twice a year, then some areas are more prone to landslides than other. And they've got like yellow zone, which is a slight risk, and the red zone, which is high risk. We'd normally avoid the red zone warning areas. The rest of it is a bit difficult to avoid in Japan because that can happen anywhere. I mean, there are some areas that are more prone to earthquakes than others, but it's not like anywhere in Japan is immune.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, okay. I've been monitoring it because I'm not going over there in late October, so yeah, I wanted to make sure I was clear of the typhoon as much as possible.
Yep.
Yeah, all right. Do you have any like examples of available? I thought we should have asked you to find some. Just because I've been looking through the websites and it's hard to sort of navigate around, I found. And a lot of them, they want like a paid subscription to then view more. Like, okay, so it'll get, you'll use it for a time and then you'll get to a point where it grays out, as in to say you got to upgrade to go any further. So,
I haven't had that issue. I'm not sure which properties, which websites you're looking at. Do you know Akiamart?
Yeah, that was one of them.
Well, like, that's the only one I would get a subscription for, because they scrape all of the major property websites and present them to you in English with that dynamic map interface. You don't get that in any Japanese website.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
The others, I would normally focus on the Japanese websites, not on the... Sorry?
Was it Sumo and there was another one?
Yeah, Sumo at Homes, Nifty Homes, homes.co.j. But Akiamart scrapes all of those, so that's the easiest way to get access to them as well.
Right, okay. That's good. Just one-stop shop then. There's no need to go to the others.
Well, yeah, in a sense. I mean, you're looking for investment properties, so I wouldn't even look at any of these websites. I'd look at, there's two major websites called Rakumachi and Kenbia. Those are the ones that are geared towards investment properties. I'll send you the links. Give me a second.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thanks for that.
There, it's just very easy to quickly see if the property is tenanted or not and how much you're paying every month. And with the other websites, because they're generic, they include investment properties and also owner-occupied properties. So it's not as easy to find the financial data that you're looking for. But these two, I'll send you these two on WhatsApp now. They're the best ones for investment properties. This one and that one.
I'll go back to the main question, I think, which was the buying process, Holden. So if I do decide to, like, obviously go with your service, you sent me the breakdown in I think it was like Excel spreadsheet, but I just wanted to, because I've been listening to it on your podcast as well. And
oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, that's how I discovered you. So I've just been listening to both you, Emil Gorgis, there's a Tracy as well, Anton, watching their...
Oh wow! You're a serious subscriber. You know all of them.
No, it's been interesting. Yeah. Talk me through it. Like, say for example, I'll take you on as, or you take me on as your client, I'm your customer. How does it start?
I'll explain how we normally work, and then I'll caveat all of that because we're working a little bit differently in the last and next few months. But basically, the way it would normally work is you'd give us authority to act on your behalf in Japan. So there's two documents you need to have signed and witnessed by a JP.
Yeah.
And then we can start... Sorry?
Oh, I'm just writing it down, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we'll start... I mean, we'll research potential properties for you, we'll discuss them, we'll tell you what we think about them, help you prioritize them, and then once we have a short list, we'll start contacting the listing agents on your behalf and trying to get more info about the listing. And then if it's a condo unit, we'll submit an offer, and the offer will be pending the building's due diligence. So we want to see the renovation history, we want to see how much they've got in their reserve funds, make sure that, because if the reserve funds pool is depleted and they haven't done any big renovations in the last 10 years, then there's definitely a big one or two coming up which they'll have to jack up the building fees for.
Yeah.
So building fees will always go up, but we want them to go up slowly and gradually, not like double overnight. So that's due diligence. If we're submitting an offer on a house, we'll usually, depending on the age of the property, but definitely at your budget, it'll be an old one. So we'll pen the offer on a structural inspection report. And then once the offer is accepted, we'll go ahead and commission a structural inspection, which is going to cost you about $1,500. And then based on the results of the report, we'll advise whether we want to go ahead or not, or if it's something that's kind of, you know, not too major, but is going to cost a fair bit, then we might try to reduce the price a little bit based on that. But only to a point. I mean, Japanese properties are basically priced correctly, and it's not really a haggling kind of market. So we can try 10%, maybe 15% off if it's vacant. But on tenanted properties, that's not going to be likely because they're priced based on the yield that they can generate, right?
Okay, yeah.
And then once the offer has been accepted, we'll get the due diligence info, we'll review it, confirm it, you know, give, it'll always be your decision, but we'll advise whether we think that's a good one to green light or not. And then once we decide we're going ahead, the seller's agent will prepare the draft of the contract and all the appendixes relating to the property itself. We'll review them if we're happy with them, or make some amendments if not. And then we'll have a signing meeting, sign the contract, pay 10% deposit. And then the property lawyer starts working on ownership transfer documents, which will send to you. You'll need to have them signed and witnessed and posted back to us. So that whole process takes another month. So from the moment an offer is accepted until settlement, usually about 2 months. If it's a house and we also do a structural inspection, maybe up to 3 months.
Okay.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo or online, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $497 per month. And if that's not enough, if you've mentioned you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you want, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob on robert@innovatius.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to increase your website's appeal, and provide you with an easy-to-read detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
And then management is management. So we'll appoint a property manager, or if the existing property manager seems to be doing a good job, we might leave them in place. You can't open a bank account in Japan as a non-resident. So we'll be collecting your rental income for you and then sending it back to you whenever you tell us to. I would advise to just send it back when the rates swing your way. Don't like withdraw it every few months on principle, because then you'll get stung by exchange rates.
Yeah, okay.
So like don't invest with money that you need back in a hurry. Let it rest until the yen becomes stronger or the dollar becomes weaker, and then transfer it over.
Yeah. And that looks like that's what's slowly happening now.
Yeah, it's been good the last couple of weeks. I mean, good for us. Maybe not good for buyers, but and then so the property, the tenant will sign up for utilities on their own. In some of the older buildings, the water supply might be communal. There's not individual meters for each unit, so then there's just a monthly fee that needs to be paid to the owner union for water.
Okay.
It's usually something like 15, 20 bucks a month. So if the property happens to be vacant, you still need to pay that. Kind of like your building fees, right? Like the management fee, the reserve fund. It's got nothing to do with whether you have a tenant or not. Just needs to be paid.
Yeah, that covers like power and water. Like external. What about the external lighting and stuff like that? Is that just for strata fees that are paid by the...
Yeah, so each listing you look at has two fees attached to it with condos. One of them is management fee, and that takes care of management of the grounds, communal cleaning, water, electricity, light bulbs, that kind of thing. And then the other component is reserve fund contribution, which goes into the reserve fund pool. And that's what they use for bigger renovations and repairs. And that's the one we want to look at in due diligence.
Yeah, okay. That's like a, it used to be called a sinking fund over here.
It's sinking fund, yeah,
building,
that's the one.
Building works.
Yeah. I know, we got customers from so many different countries and they each call it something completely different. I've given up trying to catch up with them. And then insurance, so we'll put in place for you a disaster insurance, which covers fires, earthquakes, tsunamis, that kind of thing. We'll also put in place a landlord insurance to cover you. Insurance is generally very cheap in Japan. It'll be a few hundred dollars for a 5-year policy for the disaster insurance on a condo unit, yeah? And then something like 50 bucks a year for landlord insurance. And that covers you in a case where your tenant dies in the property, which unfortunately happens a lot in Japan because a lot of the population are elderly here.
Yeah.
I'd say about 5 to 8% of our tenants die in the property.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you want to get a landlord insurance, 50 bucks a year. That'll cover you for up to 1 million yen for renovations and repairs when a tenant dies there. And more importantly, it'll cover you for up to 2 years of missing or reduced rents. Because a property which somebody died in can be a bit more challenging to rent out for the same price.
Ah, so it covers the rent.
Up to 2 years of missing or reduced rent. Yeah, after a only after a death. Yeah.
Yeah. After death. Okay. Yeah. Well. All right.
Yeah, and the owner union has their own insurance policy for the entire structure.
Do you know like the average of those? Like, what's the average for what was that reserve fund contribution? Like, what do you?
There's no average. It depends on the size of the building and the age of the building and how quickly they've been hiking it. Like, you'll often find a lot of cases where they left the reserve fund low for as long as they could. Because they didn't, you know, they didn't want to piss off the investor owners. And then when the building reaches about 30, 35 years of age, they suddenly start scrambling and raising the fees because they suddenly need to do bigger renovations.
Yeah.
So I can't say one is like a low one is better than a high one, because a high one actually compensates for stuff that will need to be done. But a low one gives you better yield on purchase. So I wouldn't judge it by the amount that they're charging. I judge it more by what kind of renovation history they have, how well they've been taking care of the building, and do they have enough for the next big renovation?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, so that's sort of like, I mean, I guess that's quite a large...
And also, I mean, look, a nicer building will have more gardens around it and nicer communal areas and maybe an on-site manager and delivery lockers. Stuff like that also increases your monthly fees, but it also attracts tenants, right?
Well, do you know, is that the same with the management fee? That's obviously going to vary as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like both the reserve fund fee and the management fee can vary depending on the building and how it's been managed. So...
Yeah.
There's no rule of thumb. It's a case by case thing.
Okay. All right. They got this insurance. Yeah, it's like, is it home and contents? No. It's like landlord. I guess it's like landlord insurance. The landlord insurance, is that just for the death, or is that for anything that happens within, like, I don't know, if say you damage I don't know, say they damage a bench top or a window or something like that.
The tenants will need to get their own insurance policy to cover for anything that happens to them or their possessions or any damages that they've done to the unit. But we'll also want to see that they have securities aside from that. So we'd normally, if we inherit a tenant, we'll have a look at what the tenant provided when they signed up. It'll be either a security deposit, which is usually 1 month, or they would have signed up with a guarantee company, which covers up to 3 months in case of any absconding or owed rent or damages they caused to the property or whatnot. So we'd prefer to have a guarantee company, which is a higher compensation for the landlord.
Okay.
If the tenant that you're inheriting doesn't have that, then you can ask them to sign up for it, but then you'll have to pay for the sign-up fee. You can't suddenly change their lease mid-lease, yeah?
When you say the sign-up fee, that's, well, not that much.
It's about a month of rent, usually.
Okay. Right.
And then, depending on the guarantee company, maybe every 2 years you have to renew that again for the same fee.
Right. Okay. Geez, we've covered a lot, really. I don't know where to...
We can go on for days, man. Are you guys, by the way, if you like the JREP crew, you should sign up for our summit next month. There's a streaming ticket if you're not here.
I've listened to that. I heard that, yeah. Sounds interesting. Because I can view it online, can't I?
Yeah. You can get a streaming ticket and then you'll be able to float questions live to the panel and chat with the other people. There'll be some experienced investors in the chat room as well.
Yeah, what's the fee for that? Because I didn't hear, like, do you go onto the link and it gives you that breakdown, I guess?
Oh no, there's the fees are there. The streaming ticket I think was $35 or something like that for the whole 2 days. It's not much.
Yeah. Okay. Is that US dollars, Aussie dollars?
Aussie.
Okay. Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah. I noticed that you guys, like, it seems like you've sort of built out a team with all those people.
It's more for the content. We don't actually work to. I mean, we refer people to each other, but it's not like we work together. We've each got a totally different area that we cover. So we're not stepping on each other's toes, which makes it easier to create content and events and stuff like that together.
Yeah. All right. What do I do from here now? Like, before I go ahead, like, can you like give me some examples that you find that might be worthwhile investing in? Is it I have to sign up you straight away and then you sort of do something? Because I remember you saying you guys do some little bit of research for a potential customer. So they get a feeling
we'll do a lot of research.
Viable option.
Yeah. With investment properties, we usually do most of the research ourselves, just because we kind of know what we're looking at. With holiday homes,
that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. I don't really, like, even the terminology, that's the thing as well. Where do I find out? Is there like a book or is there like an app or something where it gives the terminology from English to, no, sorry, from Japanese to English for what it means when you're looking at the actual.
There was,
you know, they got like 2DK or something like this. You know, whereas we're talking two bedroom.
Yeah, you know, I'm sending you a. I'm sending you a link. I'm sending you a link to that now. Hang on.
Does that actually give you the meaning?
It's not super comprehensive. There's a lot more terms that are not there, but it'll give you a rough idea of what people are talking about usually.
And what would you recommend for, like, something that you use to do the translations? Is it just like Google Translate or
ChatGPT, man?
Yeah.
ChatGPT, man, that's the best $20 subscription I got in my life. $20 per month.
Yeah.
It just made my everything to do with Japanese is and research and summary and translation of documents. It's a killer.
You speak it though, don't you?
Sorry?
You speak Japanese?
I speak very casual Japanese, but they speak, they've got levels of politeness. I'm supposed to talk in a totally different way when I'm talking to a customer, a totally different way when I'm talking to somebody that I'm a customer of, honorifics. My Japanese is very casual, but I'm on the customer side of the business, so I get away with it.
Yeah.
But I'll just share. Oh, I can't share a screen. We're not on Zoom, are we? Oh, we are on Zoom. Oh no, we are on Zoom. Okay.
Yeah, so, you can share the screen.
Yeah. Okay. So let me switch off my camera and I'll share a screen. Give me a sec.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
You seeing my screen?
Yeah.
So these are just some samples we've researched on behalf of other customers last month. This is the August sheet. So here's one unit in Fukuoka City. 3.7 million yen, which is super rare these days. 5 minute walk to a station, actually near a university campus, this one, so a bit of the best of both worlds.
It looks like a tidy complex too.
Doesn't look too bad. 1996, not that old. Yeah, it's concrete. Anything over 3-4 floors is usually going to be concrete.
Okay,
second floor, built 1996. Good spot, not super central, but good spot, and that generates about 4.4%.
Okay.
Let's have a look here. Here's one in Kyoto for 4 million yen. Also 3 minutes walk to a station. Again, nothing major or super central, but people need to live in the cheaper suburbs too, right? That's actually where the highest yield tends to be. 4.3%. Here's one in Kumamoto City, so one of the smaller cities that I was mentioning, but actually a very good city to invest in at the moment, because TSMC, I forgot their name, the biggest chip manufacturer in the world, Taiwanese company, they built TSM, yeah, that's the one. So they built one mega factory there a couple of years ago, and now they liked it so much they're building a second one. There's a lot of people moving there looking for a job from domestic and overseas. So it's an up and rising town. Transactions have picked up, but prices haven't gone up yet. So there we can get slightly higher yields. You can see this one's about 5.5%.
Yeah, what was the purchase price for that?
8 million.
Okay.
Top end of your range, but it's a larger than normal. No, it's not like a closet. It's 45 square. It's good for a couple or maybe even a couple with a toddler kind of thing, right?
Is that two bedrooms? Is it or?
That is a, let me look at the, oh, no floor plan. I can tell you, let me see the link. Maybe the link has a floor plan. It'll probably be
gone. Are you allowed to change the internal floor plan at all? Like,
anything internal is up to you. Yeah, you can, as long as you're not knocking down support beams, yeah?
Nah, so if you can put up a false wall to make another room, you can do that.
You could, but I don't know, depends on the tenant. Some of them prefer more rooms, some of them prefer bigger and less, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, yeah, that 45 one, you could potentially make that a two-bedroom subject to how the layout of the property is, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the size will still be the same. It will appeal to different kinds of tenants, but it's not going to, like, change your rent that much.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't say if it's a 1DK, 2DK. I'm assuming it's a 2DK or 2 or 1LDK, maybe.
Yeah.
Listing doesn't say. And then those are buildings. That's over your budget. That's a little bit over your budget, 13 million. This one's 6 million in Tokyo. That's really rare that we find anything yielding that much in Tokyo, but apparently there was a 5.5% return in Tokyo.
Oh, okay.
A little bit of a walk to the station, but I mean, it's Tokyo. I wouldn't complain. It's a good tenant base, even if it's longer than 10 minutes, but I wouldn't go beyond 15-minute walk to a station.
Yeah, okay.
Harder to get tenants.
So these are all ones that you actually found, not the customer's not finding these days. These are the ones you guys researched and found for them.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can see that they all come. After, yeah. You can see that they all come from those two websites that I sent to you, either Kenbia or Rakumachi.
And then, how does it work? Where, you like the look of the building. Obviously, a photo could be taken years ago. It might not be. You know what I mean? Like it could be edited to make it look better than what it is. Do you guys do a visual inspection, like go there to the site and have a look, or
we can if you want to, but Japanese realtors are honest. They're not going to put in ancient photos in there.
Right, okay.
And with investment properties, you can't enter a tenanted property even when you buy it. There's no like internal inspection even with a change of ownership, so going to the property doesn't mean we'll be able to do much except just walk around the building.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically the way it would normally work is we'd get paid our fixed price in advance based on what you think the purchase budget is going to be, and then post-settlement will credit or debit depending on the final purchase price. And from that point, we'll start researching, due diligence, conducting, we'll do everything on your behalf, and we'll present you with results, and you kind of make just bottom-line decisions and tell us what to do. But at the moment, we're a bit swamped with clients and just hiring and training 5 new staffers. So we're not going to be able to do the full purchase facilitation until early next year. What I have been doing in the last 5-6 months is I put people directly in touch with a foreigner-friendly realtor who's able to facilitate the purchase remotely in English on your behalf, same as we would have done. Okay. They're still realtors, though, so they are Japanese, they are honest, but they're not going to have strategic conversations with you. Like, they're not going to, the kind of talk that we just had about the age of the building, the size of the unit, which asset classes are better to go for, which locations, they don't do much of that. So I've been coming on as consultant for a few $100 and holding people's hands as they work with the agent and then making sure that everything is checked.
Are you still able to do that then?
That we're able to do, yeah. It's just the full purchase facilitation where we do everything on your behalf and you don't need to talk to anybody else. That's going to take a few months.
Yeah, okay. All right. I mean, yeah.
It's a lot cheaper than hiring us for a full purchase as well.
Oh, but yeah. I mean, you get what you pay for though, right? Then you know, it's one company managing everything
the management we're still not we can do the management, so after settlement we'll take it over and manage it for you and appoint the property manager. We'll do all of that.
Okay, good.
And during the purchase as well, even if we go the consulting way, I'll be with you every step of the way. We'll make sure everything's done correctly, but you will have to communicate with the agent and sign more documents than you would if we were doing everything on your behalf. You're going to be more involved, but we'll still be there every step of the way.
Okay. Good to know. When you say more documents, you're talking like, I don't know, like one or two or three more documents, or you're talking like a whole stack of different documents?
When you work through us for full purchase facilitation, you just give us permission to act on your behalf, and then we sign everything on you. So we'll sign the contract, we'll sign affidavit, statutory declarations. We'll receive and provide information to the listing agent and so forth. If we're doing consulting, then you'll be doing that in front of a buyer side agent instead of us. So it'll be the same documentation, but they'll need a few more iterations of it for each and every. So yeah, maybe, I don't know, 3-4 more documents in total. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, okay. All right. Is there like examples of these, or can you send me blank documents so that I can just have those as guides as well? Or is that like, obviously when I've engaged with you guys, so I know.
Well, for consulting, there's no engagement documents. We just need a retainer fee of 10 hours paid in advance. You don't need to give us any legal authority because you'll be working directly with the agent. The documents are pretty simple. I mean, it's like an affidavit allowing the property lawyer to transfer ownership over to your name for that particular property, stuff like that.
Okay. And then, like, where it says freehold and leasehold, obviously freehold means you own the land and the building. Is that the same with the condo, or it's not the same? Like, is that...
Most of them are freehold. The total land plot of the building gets distributed between the owners, so you own a fraction of the land.
Yeah,
but it's freehold.
I have seen some of the leasehold on.
Yeah, there are leasehold properties in Japan. Yeah, they exist in Japan, but they're a small percentage of the market, and I'd advise not to go for them.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. It's not something you do here that often, either.
They're obviously not going to hold their value because the only thing that holds value is the land.
Yeah.
And if and when the landowner decides not to renew the leasehold, which could happen once every 20 years or what, then, you know, the owners are responsible for demolishing and removing the structures.
Yeah.
And plus, when you resell it, then you can only resell it to cash buyers because banks will not approve a mortgage for a leasehold property.
Yeah.
So it's kind of limiting. It's not really worth it unless there's a very good reason to go for that one.
What about if I'm considering, say I buy a condo, but I want to buy something else that I want to utilize as maybe like storage, as in, I don't know, say for example, I buy a car there, I want to park it. Obviously the condo doesn't allow for that. So is there like a cheap house I could buy, park it in the garage there? You know what I mean? Like this, I'm just thinking of other reasons as to for a house.
Yeah, they exist, but, Do you want to pay like $50,000 just to park your car somewhere? I don't know.
No, like it doesn't have to be like that can be like an hour or an hour and a half away somewhere. I'm not worried about that. It's more unless it, like I said, like I can buy a car space or a garage. Do you know what I mean? That sort of thing, or a small warehouse. I don't know.
Yeah, you can. They exist. They exist. We can help you buy one if you want. I'm not sure about prices, though. We haven't sold many of those. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. This like storage facility. Do they have those over there? Is that like a big thing? Because it's becoming a big thing. In Australia.
You mean to buy and rent and buy and rent out to like a commercial tenant?
Or even just for yourself, like I'll just buy the unit. I'm hoping that because they're pretty cheap here, you know, relatively anyway. They've gone up a lot since it's become a thing, but yeah, you buy a storage unit, I don't know, you can put a car in there, you put, I don't know, valuables or just furniture, whatever. Do they have those facilities?
Yeah, they exist, or you can just buy vacant land and put a prefab on it.
Yeah, well, that's probably more beneficial because then you got a bit of capital growth over time, the longer you have it.
Yeah, both exist.
You can use it for other things later if you want to develop it. So I'm more thinking in that way. So if that's an option, then that's great too.
Yeah, of course they exist. It's the world's second biggest property market. They gotta exist.
Yeah. Wow, it's the world's second biggest. Wow. Yeah. Mate, I think we've covered a lot, to be honest. I don't know. Yeah,
we'll have a lot more to-ing and fro-ing when we're actually looking at particular properties. But yeah, the basics I think we've probably covered.
Yeah. All right. Anything more you want to add? Because I'm probably going to jump off now and start cooking dinner. So.
Yeah, no, go for your life. Cool. I think that's it. My pleasure. Thanks. If and when you're ready to pull the trigger, if it's before the end of the year or early next year, I can do that via consulting, or from next year we should be able to onboard you for full purchase again.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, do I go there and visit? I don't know. It's only, October's not far away, I guess. I can hold off until I'm actually there and physically seen Japan, then I'll know.
Well, if we're looking at turnkey tenanted properties, again, you're not going to be able to enter, so we're happy to show you around buildings.
So it'll probably be like November.
Hello?
No, you're breaking up there.
Sorry, I lost you there for a minute.
You're breaking up. Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Hello.
Am I back now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah. You are. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah. So when you're coming in November, where in Japan were you planning to go?
Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto. It's a lot crammed in. As I mentioned, it's more like a family holiday, so I won't be doing all the things I would have liked to have otherwise done, like had a look at the market and that sort of thing. So I'll just be all the typical touristy things. So that'll be... I won't be able to go and have a look at properties, I don't think. I just won't have the time. At the moment, there for a short time.
All right. Well, I mean, those cities would give you enough of a... At least you'll get a feel of the neighborhoods and what, you know, what the properties look like, at least from the outside, right?
Yeah, that's right. Definitely. If I'm there, maybe I could give you a call when I'm there.
Please.
I'll just message you on WhatsApp and see if you're available.
Yeah. Please, anytime. We're based in Fukuoka, but I get to Osaka and Tokyo a few times a year. We'll see if we can make it happen.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, appreciate your time, Ziv. It's nice to put a name to the face. I mean, I've seen you on YouTube, that sort of thing, but yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, once again, yeah. Appreciate your time and look forward to hopefully doing business with you.
Yeah. Anytime, we're here.
Great.
All right, talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
So there you have it. As promised, super deep dive into all things related to property investment here in Japan. I hope you found some value in this episode. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.